WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point. I love that music. The Olympic flame has officially been lit. Skaters and bobsledders, skiers and snowboarders, the best of the best, are coming together for the love of sport and, of course, to bring glory to their countries and to themselves. And from geopolitics to doping, there's plenty of controversy competing for attention in South Korea, too. This hour on Point, the Olympics in Pyeongchang. You can join us on air or online. Did you get up at the crack of dawn to watch the live stream of the opening ceremonies, the drama of the torch lighting the cauldron, the pride of the national teams? Are you waiting to watch the pomp and pageantry in primetime? What are your must-see events? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Pyeongchang, South Korea, is Rory Carroll. He's a sports correspondent for Reuters who is covering the Olympics in South Korea. Earlier today, he covered the opening ceremonies. Rory, thanks for staying up late to join us and remind us, what time is it over there?
Hi, Indira. Yes, it's just past 1 a.m. here in Pyeongchang.
Oh, that is a long day. You have our deep gratitude. All right, so no full-on spoilers, please, for our listeners who are waiting to watch this tonight at home. But give us a taste of the opening ceremonies. Any special theme or emotions on display?
Well, it is a spectacular opening ceremonies. South Korea did itself proud tonight. Hosting this Olympics, something they wanted to do in 2010 but lost out to Vancouver, wanted to do it again in 2014 and lost out to Sochi. They really made the most of it tonight. Spectacular, and I won't give it all away, but it's definitely worth tuning in.
As good as London? I think that's been my favorite so far.
It's so different because it's a Winter Games. But I would say it's right up there with the best.
Oh, great.
Sure.
Great. All right. So North and South Korean athletes were in the procession as a joint team under a unified flag. Explain the background for us and what was the reaction in the stadium to them marching in together?
Well, yeah, on top of the pyrotechnics and the incredible display that was put on there tonight, this must be the newsiest opening ceremony in decades. You had Shinzo Abe sitting with Moon Jae-in, the leader of South Korea.
With the leader of Japan.
With the leader of Japan, with the U.S. Vice President and his wife, Mike Pence, and Kim Jong-un's kid sister, as well as the nominal head of state of North Korea, all closely seated in a VIP box overlooking the ceremony.
Wait. Are you telling me that Vice President Mike Pence was in the same box with Kim Jong-un's sister?
It's outdoor box, but they are very closely seated. Kim Jong-un's sister was seated a few rows behind him and smiling the whole time. And for sure, the biggest moment of this opening ceremony is a handshake between South Korean leader Moon and Kim Jong-un's smiling kid sister.
Okay, but none with Vice President Pence that we know of.
No. So that's a whole other story here. But just to stick on the Korea aspect, you have never seen a member of the Kim family come to the South. So that's a first right there. It's the first time you've seen the athletes marching, as you said, under a unified banner. This unified Korea flag, that's amazing. They'd done that in 2006, I believe it was, but that's extremely rare. The theme of this opening games was unity, and I think peace through movement was the tagline for this opening ceremony. At one point, they're playing, well, I don't want to give it away, but at one point, they do play John Lennon's Imagine. So they're really trying to promote peace and that they're getting along, and to use these Winter Games as a way to thaw the tension between North and South.
Well, so, I do want to say, though, there were some protests from South Koreans expected before the ceremonies. Not everyone in South Korea thought that this warming was great, right?
Oh, absolutely. We saw lots of hundreds of protesters, maybe thousands of protesters around the stadium beforehand. There's There's a very hard right group in South Korea that are completely opposed to any negotiations. I saw a sign with one woman holding a sign that said, "President Trump, please start bombing North Korea." So there was definitely people not on board with the idea of unity between the two. But that is definitely the priority for South Korea, which wants to put forward a modern face to the world. You know, it's a technological marvel, South Korea, and it wants to show that it's not mired in these geopolitical battles with its northern neighbor.
All right. Well, briefly, Rory, let's revisit the Mike Pence aspect of this, which is that he's leading the U.S. delegation. And with him as his guest at the opening ceremonies is the father of Otto Warmbier, the college student who was imprisoned by the brutal North Korean regime, released only when he was a coma and died shortly after he returned to the United States. What is the significance of the vice president bringing his father to the games while the Koreans march under a united flag?
Well, it's certainly sending a message that the United States is still very much at odds, sworn enemy with North Korea, and that incident, of course, being tragic and wanting to not forget that incident at all. Mike Pence did not shake hands with Kim Jong-un's sister. He, you know, sat stone-faced through much of the opening ceremony, although he stood and applauded for the United States athletes when they entered into the arena. But there was a cocktail party beforehand for VIPs that we learned about that had a dessert that was a unified, again, Korea on a cookie, and then a barbed wire made of chocolate through the middle of it, representing the heavily militarized DMZ zone, and then invited guests to pour white chocolate over the dark chocolate to erase that barbed wire.
Okay, that is crazy. I've never heard of chocolate barbed wire. I don't know if I really have an appetite for that, but I can see that they're going at least for culinary creativity. They get points for that. All right, let's switch gears for a moment to the Russian Olympic delegation, which was banned from these games because of state-sponsored doping at the games in Sochi 4 years ago. 47 Russian athletes just today lost their appeal, but 169 Russian athletes who were deemed to be clean walked under the Olympic flag instead of the Russian flag. What was the reception like for them?
The reception was much the same as it was for others from the crowd, because it was so cold in the arena that few people could really make noise or clap very loudly for much. But you saw many still people in the stands in Russia, you know, clothing, sports gear, proudly, you know, proud Russians still showing up, still supporting their team, even if that team is Olympic athletes from Russia as opposed to the Russian Olympic team.
All right. Well, I read that South Korea built a $109 million open-air stadium, the one you're referring to as being so brutally cold, and that it's only going to be used four times during the games. Was it worth it?
It's very nice. It's a 35,000 person capacity stadium. They are going to use it, like you said, four times. It'll be used for closing ceremonies as well. It sits next to a river that was solid, frozen solid, where they launched fireworks off of. We saw them setting up the fireworks on the ice before, you know, hours before the opening ceremony. It's a lovely stadium. I don't know that that's a great investment if you're not going to be using it after the fact. I believe they are planning to tear it down, but leave certain, areas around it, around its legacy, Olympic legacy.
Wow. We could do an entire show just on what countries spend to show off to the world during the Olympics, but that's another topic. All right. I know it's supposed to be a plum assignment to cover the Olympics, so congratulations to you, but it is bitterly cold over there. There is a 14-hour time difference. We hear there's a norovirus outbreak. Has it turned into a hardship posting for the international media?
I wouldn't go that far. It is, there are certainly challenges. I think Rio presented challenges as well. It has been as cold as -4 at night in recent weeks.
Fahrenheit, to be clear to our international listeners, which makes it even colder.
Yes, -20 Celsius, I believe that would be. So tonight, probably in the low 20s. Was as bad as it got. The thing is, the wind cuts through you when it comes across, and that's that was kicking up a little tonight, and that's expected to continue the next couple days, which is a shame because it looks like the men's downhill in alpine skiing, which is scheduled for Sunday, is likely to be delayed because of those winds. So we're already looking at some setbacks.
All right, you've got a few seconds left. Just tell us which events and athletes you're most looking forward to seeing.
Oh, you know, I've got Lindsey Vonn in the downhill for the women. She's been on a tear her last few races, and I think she's got a good shot at gold. Michaela Schifrin, same.
All right. We will be watching with you and reading your stories. Rory Carroll from Reuters joining us from South Korea. Thank you. We're going out with the sound of Korean musicians at the Games. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point.
This episode of On Point is supported by 23andMe. This Valentine's Day, give someone special a DNA kit from 23andMe. They can receive over 75 detailed online reports about their genetic ancestry, inherited traits, and even information about their health. Go to 23andme.com/onpoint to get 20% off each kit, now through February 14th. Offer includes free gift wrap.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're talking about the 2018 Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. And you can join our conversation. Are geopolitics and steroids ruining the spirit of the games for you? Or are you watching for the love of sport? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio or online onpointradio.org. Joining me now from New York is Jason Stallman, sports editor for The New York Times. He's coordinating coverage from the Olympics. Thanks so much for joining us, Jason.
Hi, Indira.
And from Austin, Texas, John Hoberman, Olympic historian at the University of Texas, Austin, and author of The Olympic Crisis, Sport, Politics, and the Moral Order. Thank you for joining us, John.
Hi, Indira.
All right. So, Jason, tell us about the main events. What are most U.S. viewers going to be most excited to watch?
Well, most U.S. viewers are, I guess, at the mercy of NBC's programming schedule. And what a lot of U.S. viewers are going to get are figure skating, men's figure skating, because Nathan Chen is such a big story, and probably also a lot of alpine skiing. Michaela Schifrin is expected to win multiple gold medals, so I would be surprised if NBC didn't try to ride her as much as possible.
Well, I remember back in the day, it used to be all about women's figure skating and the double Lutz and the, you know, triple axel. And now it seems that it's all about snowboarding, which has its own language. Here's snowboarder Shaun White scoring a perfect 100 at the U.S. Grand Prix event in January to qualify for the Olympic team, where he's going for his third gold. He performed two of the toughest tricks on the half pipe. You know, this is all fun to watch, but I have no idea what they're talking about. Let's listen.
Going for it right now. 14-40 stopped. Oh, boy, he is going for the win.
cab, double, 1080, and there is the skyhook, making it all his own into the tomahawk. Stomped. Oh, boy, what has he got for the last hit? Front up,
Wow. Sean White! Sean White on the final run of the day, dropping bomb!
All right, well, that sounds totally awesome. How could you not be excited about that? But when they're talking about the double MC twist 1260 and the front side double cork 1440, I mean, it kind of feels, Jason, like some of this has all got its own language.
It definitely does. If you can figure out the sal cows and the triple axles, you can figure this out too, I guess. You know, it's interesting the evolution of these sports that are popular at the Olympics. You're right. Back in the day, it was all about women's figure skating in the United States. But they changed the scoring system, and the United States figure skating program has not adapted very deftly, whereas countries like Japan and Russia have taken full advantage. So a lot of their skaters are excelling while the American women are falling rather far behind. So that sport is losing some relevance, at least in this Olympic cycle, whereas Americans do quite well in halfpipe. Another breakout star that NBC, I think, will be featuring quite a bit is Chloe Kim, a teenager expected to win gold in the halfpipe. That could be, a new-ish sport for a lot of viewers.
All right. Well, let's bring in one of our callers. John is calling us from West Allis, Wisconsin. Welcome, John.
Hello, Indira.
Hi.
I wasn't going to listen to watch the Olympics until after I saw the Olympic speed skating here in West Allis. And there is a 17-year-old African-American woman who's going to be racing in the short race, the 500-meter. I don't know her first name, but I think her last name is Biney. And when I saw her race, I was just flabbergasted, and I thought, my God, I got to watch this Olympics, and I think she's skating on Tuesday night. So in my opinion, she is equivalent to the Williams sisters in tennis. I get goosebumps thinking about what she can do in the Olympics, and I encourage people to watch the short 500-meter women's speed skating race and enjoy the athleticism of the 17-year-old.
All right. I'm going to put it on my calendar and set an alarm for it. So thank you for the tip. But, you know, tell us, Jason, this sounds like one of the breakout stars. What's the story behind this young African-American woman in speed skating?
17-year-old, born in Ghana. It's certainly rare for short track speed skaters, for African-Americans to compete at the Olympic level in short track speed skating. She is exceptional in a lot of ways. And it also is a high-profile sport this time because South Korea historically has done so well in short track speed skating. It is in some ways like their national Winter Olympic sports, the sport they've won so many medals in. So it'd be a big marquee attraction in the host country. And Biney certainly will be a great storyline for American viewers.
Well, the mention of the skating reminds me that actually a coin toss determined who would carry the stars and stripes during the opening ceremonies for the U.S. team, and it caused quite a bit of controversy. Tell us what happened.
Apparently it went down to two athletes, and they decided to break the tie by flipping a coin, and Shawnee Davis, another speed skater,
who's also African-American.
Disappointed. It's also African-American, was miffed, perhaps understandably. The woman who was the flag bearer is Hamlin a loser.
All right. I have to say, everybody talks about Lindsey Vonn. You can't get away from her. She's got to be, I think, the most famous name, along with Sean White, going into this Olympics, the veteran. She was on the Today Show last week. It's been 8 years since she competed in the Olympics because she's been struggling with a lot of injuries. Now she has her eye on gold.
I feel like this is going to be a really good Olympics for me, probably, you know, closing out my career. To have one more chance at the Olympics, I think, is going to be great. Watching Sochi on TV was not what I wanted to be doing at all. I'd worked so hard from the previous injury to be able to come back and then to just blow my knee out again just a few months before the Olympics was really heartbreaking.
So NBC is, of course, great at giving us the human drama stories. What do you see? You know, this is the comeback kid type story. What do you see as the most interesting feature stories or human interest stories coming out of the games?
It's a great question. I mean, there are so many. I think internationally, even probably surpassing Vaughn's popularity is a Japanese figure skater named Yuzuru Hanyu. He is an absolute phenomenon in many corners of the world, and he has a huge following of fans who show up at all of his events, and curiously, they throw Winnie the Pooh dolls on the ice.
It's okay.
Kind of his mascot of sorts, his chosen mascot. You know, Vaughn at age 33, preparing to race down a hill at upwards of 70 miles an hour is certainly irresistible to watch, I guess. So, yeah, I guess every country has their own, marquee attractions. There's a Nigerian bobsled team that, okay, they're not going to win gold, but they certainly have a great backstory and largely in track and field. So, yeah, you can just pick any country almost and find a fascinating story.
All right. One of our listeners comments on our website, let's talk about what's really going on at the Olympics, like how much money is made in official sponsorships. And he says the number of condoms passed out in the athletes' village. Okay, John, I want to turn the conversation a little bit to the politics and the controversy behind all of this. Your latest book is on performance-enhancing drug use. Bring us up to date on the punishments that were meted out and then reversed for Russians doping in the last Winter Olympics.
Well, one of the important developments in this Olympiad and the run-up to the Olympiad was that the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, has opposed the absolute banning of Russia from the 2018 Winter Games in relation to the great Russian doping scandal that was exposed by reports in 2016 and 2017. He opened the door to a great deal of complication and controversy by not simply banning state-sponsored doping such as Putin had carried out. I think that was a big mistake. I'm not alone in that opinion. But what happened was that originally there were going to be almost 400 Russian athletes allowed. As of today, as someone mentioned, there are 169 Russian athletes allowed, 45 athletes and two coaches from Russia who just appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, lost their appeal last night, and so they're out. One assumes that IOC President Bach is not too pleased about that because he owes Putin for spending $50 billion on the 2014 Sochi Games. So you have Putin, in effect, realizing his goal for any Olympiad, and that was brilliantly realized at Sochi when Russia won the medal count in those Winter Olympic Games. Putin was devastated by the lousy Russian results at Vancouver in 2010. Heads rolled. He said, that's never going to happen again. And so you get the enormous investment in Sochi, both in terms of state and private funding, $50 billion. And then, of course, this sub rosa concealed cheating scheme that was described by one of the three whistleblowers who is now hiding out in the United States in fear for his life. And, you know, this is an opportunity to make a point that is rarely made, that the advent of Vladimir Putin into Olympic and global sport has involved a criminalization, a gangsterizing of the whole anti-doping situation that is absolutely unprecedented. In February of 2016, you have the mysterious deaths of two Russian anti-doping officials, Mr. Kamayev and Mr. Sinev. There's very, very little information on how they died. Now you have Rodchenkov and the Stepanova, the married couple, the three Russian whistleblowers. One of the things that happened yesterday before these Olympics was that the World Anti-Doping Agency announced that any whistleblowers, anti-doping whistleblowers, had better not publicize themselves because nobody can protect them.
Wow. That is fascinating stuff, John Hoberman. And I'm wondering, is there more on that in your book, Dopers in Uniform, The Hidden World of Police on Steroids?
No, that is not a sports book. That is a book on the global reach of anabolic steroid abuse.
Oh, well,
how many different
you're going to have to write a new one for us then. All right, but tell us, are the Olympic Games tainted now by this doping scandal that was uncovered in Sochi, or do fans even care?
What public survey information we have tells us that the sporting public is divided. That there are going to be people who care a lot. There are going to be people who turn off the TV. There are going to be people who are mildly concerned, and there are going to be people who simply don't care, who are tuning in for the entertainment. Are the games tainted? The games have been tainted by anabolic steroids, for example. At least since the Mexico City Olympic Games 50 years ago. 30 years ago, you had the Ben Johnson scandal at the 1988 Summer Olympic Games in Seoul. So that is what really broke open Olympic doping as a public topic.
The track and field athlete, of course.
Yeah, the Canadian sprinter and one-time world record holder, Ben Johnson. It has just been getting worse.
I have to ask you, John Hoberman, is there really anything realistically that can be done to stop this? I mean, it was a frequent dig at East German female athletes in the 80s that they were all assumed to be taking steroids. We saw it with Lance Armstrong in cycling. You mentioned Ben Johnson. Is drug use simply endemic to high-performance sport?
I'm afraid so. It is built into high-performance sport in the sense that the incentives to dope are simply overwhelming for a critical mass of people who have invested everything in developing their athletic talent, have nothing else, and whose afterlives, in fact, are often tragic because of this single-minded investment in becoming high-performance athletes. The anti-doping has improved since the World Anti-Doping Agency went into action in January of 2000. But they are underfunded. They are an IOC / government creation, which is operating on about $28 million a year, which is less than Maria Sharapova makes in a year. One question is, why has the IOC been keeping the World Anti-Doping Agency on this starvation diet? So in that sense, the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has always been behind. There was a recent anonymous survey that said 30% of the athletes were admitting anonymously that they were on performance-enhancing drugs.
Wow, almost one in three.
And it also depends on which event you're talking about. If you're talking about weightlifting, then it has been anabolic steroids from day one. If you're talking about track and field, it's especially the throwing events and the sprinting events, it's a real problem. Cross-country skiing, blood boosting, blood doping has been a problem for decades. And so this cat and mouse game, the cheaters versus the detectors, is continuing. It is constantly innovating. Microdoses of, say, testosterone are virtually undetectable, and they work apparently for 3 months. It is a very, very difficult and probably impossible situation. What's interesting is that the frequent calls for the legalization of doping that we've heard over the past years have, as far as major organizations are concerned, including American professional sports teams, they've gone nowhere. All the significant sports bodies have tightened up on anti-doping, and yet at the same time, it's a desperate situation.
Wow. Well, that's a lot to think about. We're going to be digging in on it much more. We're talking about the 2018 Olympics, which are officially kicking off in South Korea. And as we head into our short break, here's sound from the performance of Shoma Uno from Japan, who was the top finisher in the men's figure skating short program last night. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point.
Next element is very important. the quad toe triple toe.
Japan has a chance to push for bronze. This is a big element right here. Quad toe, triple toe. That was a beauty.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're talking about the Olympics in South Korea kicking off today officially. You can join our conversation. With all the tensions on the Korean Peninsula, is it impossible to take politics out of the games in Pyeongchang? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio or online, onpointradio.org. Some of you are responding already. To earlier, we were talking about the $109 million open-air stadium that's been built in Pyeongchang, which will be used only four times and then apparently demolished. And one of our listeners on the website says, it's time to rethink this whole rotating host, build a city from scratch concept. Is it a waste of money? My guests are Jason Stallman, the sports editor at the New York Times, and John Hoberman, an Olympic historian at the University of Texas at Austin. And joining us now from Pyeongchang is Suki Kim, an investigative journalist and novelist who was born and raised in Seoul, South Korea. She now lives in New York, but she did live undercover in North Korea for a year, teaching at an elite boys' school, and she wrote about it in her 2015 New York Times bestseller called Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korean Elite. Her opinion piece yesterday for the New York Times was headlined, North Korea's Lipstick Diplomacy. Thank you so much for joining us and staying up so late, Suki.
Hi, Indira. Hello.
So, Suki, first of all, tell us what that headline means, North Korea's Lipstick Diplomacy. You're referring to the women's cheering squad that came over from North Korea to the South?
Yes. North Korea, right, you know, today was the opening ceremony, and what we've been hearing a lot about is women. You know, it began with Hyun Sung-won, she was the singer with the band, the girl band that Kim Jong-un had sort of handpicked, and now she's head of the orchestra. She came first in January. And then the media was all about her looks. And then followed, of course, the cheerleaders, which the Western media, it's not that surprising, but the Western media came up with this phrase, Army of Beauties. I have actually never heard that. They don't say that in South Korea. They just call them beautiful cheerleaders. In reality, you know, they're not army and they're not cheerleaders. They're just college students who are handpicked by the regime, North Korean regime, to just send over with this whole athletes. And their role is just to look pretty. And it's really a remarkable that the world basically makes, you know, that this is based, this is acceptable in 2017.
You know,
18.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm thinking I've been to North Korea as a journalist, and, you know, this is a common technique. They introduce journalists and other official visitors to these women who are clearly handpicked, are impeccably dressed and smile and say how great the regime is. So there's, of course, there is this sort of Potemkin village aspect to it, isn't there, Suki?
I mean, the whole country is sort of run on that concept. If you go to North Korea, you know, the guides, who basically the role is to tell you how great the great leader is, would generally be young women in their 20s. And for example, even out of North Korea, you know, one of the big thing that people do go is a North Korean restaurant. There are about 100 of them in China and Southeast Asia. And people go because it's a novelty to go to a North Korean restaurant, foreigners, and they spend money. And that money is basically goes directly to the North Korean regime. And it's basically run by with these young women who they're not waitresses, but they serve you food and they sing and they dance, and that's, they're considered diplomats. And they're aged usually about like 19 to 23. And it's a diplomatic position to do that for 3 years and get sent back home. So the regime's use of young women, and they're all pretty and also handpicked, it's not that different from these young women who are in South Korea as supposedly cheerleaders that the Western media so, avidly, fiercely call army of beauties. I mean, it's unbelievable that you know, this is, it's sexism that is just sanctioned by the North Korean regime, but it's also sanctioned by the rest of the world. I guess my point in my op-ed was how complicit we are.
That's a very, very interesting point, because, of course, we know the North Koreans are using as propaganda. Your point is that we in the West are also buying into it. All right, Suki, you were born and raised in South Korea. What is it like for you to watch the North and South Korean athletes walking in under a unified Korea banner?
Well, I think that whole sentimentality is just so manipulated. And I think that's how the younger generation is really reacting. I'm looking at it as a journalist and as a, I guess, really at this point, just a person who's been watching this for a really long time, that, you know, they're marching together. And what does that mean? You know, it actually doesn't mean anything at all. You know, they've done this kind of stuff where families meet, you know, every few years, and politicians need those photo moments. So suddenly it looks like people are happy, North and South. You know, it's actually two countries that's been, one country that was separated back in 1945, 1948, you know, and then has never, ever had a contact with each other. You know, it's three generations of families, millions of people who never, ever got to meet again. And to pretend that suddenly these athletes marching together have any meaning is nonsense. And I think it's really manipulative to think it's anything but political PR moment.
Well, you're right to bring up these family reunions as an analogy, because, of course, the regime in North Korea, even under Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, used that as a leverage. And, you know, there were very few and far between where North Koreans would be brought to Seoul and they would get to meet under very limited and restricted conditions with South Korean relatives they hadn't seen for decades. And then there's this tearful parting at the end of the weekend. It sounds like you think that it's the same kind of emotional manipulation, but there's a geopolitical element too when you have the dueling insults between President Trump and Kim Jong-un and the nuclear escalation and now suddenly this joint team. So how do you see it as part of the political picture?
I mean, I don't really see what that actually does anything. You know, I think that there is sort of a retreat that needs right now, right? Because the whole banter between North Korea and the United States was heating to a point where, what is the next step? A nuclear war. So you need sort of a step back. And that's how it's been when you look at the dialogue between North Korea and South Korea and, of course, surrounding, you know, U.S. and China. However, to actually, you know, I think there are actually degrees of understanding when it comes to these relations. I mean, to pretend that this PR moment has any depth is also nonsense. You know, for example, Kim Yo-jong, Kim Jong-un's sister, just arrived into South Korea. She's basically, he's sort of right-hand person at this point. And that's Baek Dui-hyeol-tong, which is the royal family of North Korea. What is she? She's just an important person who's, and it's not that different from Ivanka Trump, who's coming also at the closing ceremony. So these are basically also young women who are representative, they're envoy of the power of a nation. In South Korea, the media reception has been atrocious, I think. You know, they've covered her visit as this VIP visit by basically a princess from North Korea. in reality, this is a woman who's been part of the most murderous dictatorship in the world.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, Suki, and hold that thought. I want to ask John Hoberman, who's an Olympic historian, this is not the first time that the two Koreas have marched under a unified flag, but this happened before, back in 1991, when they fielded a joint table tennis team at the Olympics in Chiba, Japan. All right, so put this in historical context for us. What's different today? How do you compare it with 1980 when Jimmy Carter boycotted the Olympics in Moscow because of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, I think that your previous guest is absolutely right, that symbolism is cheap. And what goes on in the real world, whether symbolic events are going to lead to any real policy, is very, very questionable. The historical context for big power politics at the Olympics really begins with the Nazi Olympics of 1936, where Hitler mounts quite a successful public relations campaign to persuade much of the world that he is leading a more peaceable regime than was actually the case. You have Mexico City in 1968, the pre-Olympic massacre of several hundred people that almost nobody knows about. You have Moscow in 1980, which was cleaned out of a lot of Jews and dissidents before the games were allowed to take place. You have Beijing in 2008, where the IOC is saying, we are going to change China and open it up. And instead, the Chinese humiliated them at the games by cracking down on free speech. You have Sochi in 2014, which included the most massive state-sponsored doping operation since East Germany. So this does fit into a long history of big power politics at the games, and I would just point out that the most interesting ones are always the ones that involve dictatorships. Usually the dictators are hosting the games, as in the case of the Nazis in 36, the Soviets in 1980, the Chinese in 2008, and the Russians in 2014. In this case, and remember, every Olympiad is different, and the political dynamics and the symbolism that is exploited, the back channel stuff, every one of these interesting Olympics is different. What's unique about this one is that the dictatorship is not doing the hosting. What it is doing is trying to use the an Olympiad for its own political goals. The North Korean dictator, on the one hand, is trying to drive a wedge between the South Korean government, which is led by a kind of a dove at this point. In fact, President Trump has accused him of appeasement on the one hand, but Kim is savvy enough when he was approached in January to know that he can get some goodwill out of this.
So you mentioned, of course, John Hoberman, that Hitler capitalized on hosting the 1936 Olympics for propaganda purposes. You're saying that Kim Jong-un of North Korea is trying to do the same, even though he's not the host. Briefly, because I want to get to some of our callers, do you think the Olympics should be an all-inclusive event that everyone attends, setting politics aside, or should we block the dictators out, not allow them to attend and participate or host?
That is my position, and I think that in this world it is an unusual position. Certainly any state-sponsored doping, which, by the way, is always carried out by dictatorships, should mean disqualification. If the IOC were to read and take seriously its own charter and to get serious about its proclaimed humanitarian goals, the dictatorships would be out. And the amoral universalism, which has been IOC doctrine for a long time, doesn't matter how despicable a regime is, it has to play because the IOC sees itself as the reconciler.
Okay,
of
sports
humanity.
Heroes in, dictators out. Let's take a call from Tom, who's calling from Syracuse, New York. Tom, you're on the line. Welcome.
Hi. I call.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I'm calling. I know it's off the political topic, but I'm calling because I just love the Winter Olympics, and I like them a lot more than the Summer Games. And my favorite events include the ice hockey and the curling. And I like and I'm going to watch ice hockey in spite of the fact that the NHL players aren't going to be there this year.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And Jason Stallman of The New York Times, that gives us an opportunity for me to ask you, are geopolitics and doping just overshadowing what is meant to be an international showcase for athletic excellence and fellowship?
That feels like it would be a bit of an overstatement. I think there are certainly some people, feels like a relatively small portion of the population, some people who are put off by the doping and perhaps consumed by it. I think, at least anecdotally, the spectators and athletes, viewers, our reporters hear from, they don't get too bothered by it. They certainly don't adjust their viewing habits accordingly.
So Jason Stallman, just in a few seconds, tell us then, who are the athletes and events that you're most looking forward to see and that you advise our listeners to keep an eye out for?
Well, to stay on the point of doping and also your caller noting ice hockey, I think the Russian men's hockey team could be quite fun to watch. Most teams are depleted because the NHL isn't participating. Russia has a very powerful team, and they'll almost likely win gold in their neutral uniforms.
All right. Thank you so much. And I know there's so much more to watch. I personally will be watching the ice skating and the slalom and the snowboarding. Jason Stallman, sports editor for The New York Times. I'll be reading your coverage to know what I've missed and what I need to be looking out for. Thank you so much for joining us. John Hoberman, Olympic historian and professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you. And Suki Kim, author of Without You, There Is No Us, which is a memoir of her year living among the sons of the North Korean elite. She joined us by Skype from Pyeongchang. Thank you so much for staying up so late with us. And you, our dear listeners, can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. It's been a privilege for me to be with you this week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point.